you, Nita Strauss and Alyssa, formerly of Arch Enemy, for leading us in with that rockin' tune, The Wolf You Feed. What a way to start this podcast. What a podcast I have for you today. It's been a while since I've spoken to you guys solo, and today I have a guest by the name of Jeremiah Kipp. Jeremiah is someone I almost worked with. About 10 years ago, we were about ready to start something, but as things go and as production companies go, things just kind of folded, and since then, he's put a pretty good career together, and he has a movie out on Shudder right now. It's called The Mortuary Assistant. That's coming up here in a few minutes. For those who came for that interview, you might want to fast forward probably about 10 minutes or so, because man, do I have things to say. And what's funny is when I recorded this interview with Jeremiah last week, and I hit stop on it, I kind of hit a lull. I was like, what the hell am I going to talk about? Because I had literally nothing to lead in, nothing to lead out. I was just going to kind of wax poetic about something like people say that we do on our podcast. I was at a standstill until this week, and holy shit, are there things to talk about. First of all, we have a lot of good things coming up on the 3-Minute Retrospective podcast, and if you want to hear some future retrospectives we have in the weeks to come, stay tuned for after the interview, because I do give out the next couple. But before I get to the interview itself, I need to talk about this last week's box office numbers. Holy shit, guys, I think we're starting to see a changing of the guard. In fact, I know we are. This weekend, in the midst of The Mandalorian and Grogu being out in theaters, it's second week, a movie that me and Jen have seen and we will be covering on the 3-Minute Retrospective here pretty soon to continue our Star Wars coverage. It was unseated, and not only was it unseated, Mandalorian and Grogu ended up losing 70% of their business to two movies. What two movies, you say? Are they the next big blockbusters? Are they the new Steven Spielberg movies? No. We have Obsession, directed by Curry Barker, who, I tell you, I look at that name, I just want to say Clive each and every time. But it's Curry Barker, and Back Rooms, directed by Kane Parsons, who is 20 years old. Holy shit. Back Rooms, this last weekend, made $81 million, guys. $81 million. Obsession has just crossed the $100 million mark. This is unreal. And you know what? I actually have two minds of this. Let's look at the short-term ramifications of this huge monumental week in box office. What does this mean in the weeks to come when we have a brand new Steven Spielberg movie coming out that I have been looking forward to forever? Big blockbuster. We have a new He-Man movie coming out. Oh, thanks for jumping right past me, Kat, as I was recording. We have a set of movies coming out with these two movies that are out right now. How much business are these two movies going to take away? What does this mean for cinema in general? Does this mean that we are going to take YouTubers? We are going to go to YouTube, find the most viral thing, and make it into a movie. They tried this in the past. In fact, I think James Wan was behind a movie based on The Slender Man a few years ago, which hit with a thud. But James Wan is actually behind Back Rooms, and he has been out on social media saying that he's very proud of Parsons. Him and Jason Blum, saw what he could do with the camera when they watched that video, and they knew that he could do this. And there have been rumors that Parsons had a ghost director while he was doing this movie, and James Wan himself has put those rumors to bed with this post, which quite honestly kind of feels like the letter that Spielberg wrote in defense of Toby Hooper way back when Poltergeist came out. But that's neither here nor there. Who knows if we'll end up covering those movies, but that's just it. What does this mean? And the long-term thing that I was really thinking about, this is me when it comes to stuff like this. Like, people look at, you know, how amazing it is that these two movies have come out and done what they've done. People were looking at Sinners last year saying, oh my god, what does this mean? This horror movie is tremendous and ends up getting 16 Oscar nominations. And you know, I even say it with Jeremiah in this interview. I said it back in the Scream 7 podcast. horror is not the, if I can do a pun here, horror is not just stuck in the back rooms of movie making anymore. Horror is not the ghetto anymore. It is very respected right now. And what I see when I look at these numbers is I am asking myself, what is Hollywood going to take away from the success of these two films? Will it be that they are going to support original ideas and horror in the indie film scene? You know, because we've seen things like this in the past. We saw Blair Witch come out in 1999, blow the doors off of Star Wars The Phantom Menace. Not necessarily. Phantom Menace still made a shit ton of money. But Blair Witch, to say it didn't take away business would probably be lying. It made a lot of money. So we've seen this in the past, but this is something that's different. This is something that YouTube has been around since around 2007 or so. I remember being in college and busting out YouTube. They have come out and said, no, we're not going to start a movie studio. We're not in the business for that. But we support anybody who wants to create original content. And that's always been our intent, blah, blah, blah. But what is Hollywood going to do with this? You know what they're going to do? They're going to do exactly what they did when Blair Witch came out. Remember when found footage was all the rage? They went and they took every little found footage film, every foreign horror film that they had, and they made it into American remakes. It is going to get exploited. And this is a huge problem for a number of reasons. I, for one, I was in the business myself for about 6 years, and I saw people working their asses off, going to school, and getting enough so that they could go buy a Red camera, which is the most expensive camera you can get to do a movie and put it out. And they've done very well. Don't get me wrong. A couple friends of mine have done really well in the indie scene. But they have not had a movie make $81 million at the box office. And Hollywood's going to take a look at this. And they are going to see it as another way to line their pockets. Meanwhile, these indie filmmakers are going to get exploited. They're going to get brushed under the rug eventually. That line will continue to shrink while executives line their pocket. I've been saying very cryptically in the last couple years of this podcast that I don't think movie theaters are here to stay. That there's coming a time, and it's coming pretty quick, that we're not going to be able to sit and watch a movie with a set of people much anymore. I think it's all going to be set to streaming. I think it's going to go away. Now, every time we say that, something happens. Like, remember Barbenheimer a few years ago? When me and the boys covered Oppenheimer back in 2023, we spent a good portion of that podcast talking about the fact that those theaters were so fucking packed. They were there to see Oppenheimer. They were there to see Barbie. They were there to see both. I remember going to the theaters that weekend. It was quite amazing to see. It was nice to see theaters packed. Hell, when me and Jen went and saw The Mandalorian, that theater was packed. However, a lot of them were going to see Obsession. Could there be another thing coming out? Could Masters of the Universe, which is getting very good word of mouth, by the way, is that going to be something that helps keep movie theaters afloat? Will Spielberg's Disclosure Day, more on Spielberg here in a bit, but will Spielberg's Disclosure Day be something that makes a ton of money? Or are executives going to look at these small films and say, ah, this is the ticket. We're going to have these filmmakers make these films for us. And this is the way our studios will be able to stay afloat because we won't have to spend more than a couple million dollars to do these films. I am very curious to see how this develops. I am very happy for Parsons. I'm very happy for Barker. I'm very happy that indie horror has taken on a life of its own. And I'm happy that people are going to cinemas again. But looking at the larger picture, how long is it going to last? That's the question. All right. Well, speaking of Steven Spielberg, he has this movie coming out called Disclosure Day. Yes, I want to get to Jeremiah here in a bit, but let me talk about Spielberg here for a bit. He's a guy who doesn't do too many podcasts. In fact, I think over the years, he's done maybe one. Yes, he does a ton of interviews for DVD features. And, you know, you'll see him on Kimmel every once in a while, or he'll show up on those things. But he's never been on a podcast where he just sits and talks. Guess what? This week, I don't know how he did it, but Bill Simmons sat Spielberg down for over 2 hours this week, and they were talking about 2001: A Space Odyssey. Now, before you stop and say, my God, couldn't you just interview him? Well, that's Bill Simmons' podcast, The Rewatchables. What they do is they take a movie, they watch it, they kind of do what me and the guys do, except they just do it one movie, not necessarily franchises. And they discussed that movie for a set of minutes. And in going in, I saw Spielberg was appearing on the Wewatchables, because I'm a member of a couple Wewatchables groups. I'm like, you know, I don't know if I want to listen to that, because I got in trouble with Jack when I would say this, and I know I'm going to get in trouble again. I am not a fan of 2001. I have tried and tried and tried to watch that movie. I cannot get into it to save my life. However, all I've been seeing is how good The Interview was. So this week, in fact, last night, was getting ready for bed because I was going to work later that night, and I turned on the Bill Simmons podcast with Steven Spielberg. It is remarkable how cool Spielberg came off in that interview. Yes, they talked about the monolith in 2001. They geeked out about 2001 a lot in the course of that podcast. And they went over Simmons' regular categories, which it was funny seeing Spielberg just go along with it. That's what was so cool about it. He could probably talk circles around Simmons and his co-host about movies. Yet you don't get the feeling that he would do that. You know, you don't get the feeling that he is looking over them. He's looking at them as equals. And all he did was sit and talk movies with those guys for over 2 hours. Yes, the main topic was 2001, but there were a couple times, like, for example, he cleared up the rumors that the guys and I actually talked about when we talked about Jaws last year. He went over the rumors that Robert Shaw and Richard Dreyfuss hated each other. And in his opinion, they didn't hate each other. They had a respect for one another. And the only reason they could get each other riled up the way they did was because of the respect they had. And yeah, that does sound a little convoluted, but listening to Spielberg talk about it, it kind of makes sense. I highly recommend checking it out. And you know what? Here's the other thing. I'm not a fan of visual podcasts, because me and Matt have appeared on a couple podcasts where we're on camera, and we've talked about maybe doing that for a YouTube channel, ironically, given the topic from 10 minutes ago. But I've always been one who just likes recording audio because, A, I'm very self-conscious about being on camera, and B, I've always wanted to be the one who accompanies someone on a drive to work, or accompanies someone on a jog, or accompanies someone at the gym as they work out. And yeah, YouTube, if you go premium, you can do that. You just turn on the app and it will, even though your phone is dim, it will keep going. But I love being on Spotify. I love being on all these podcast apps that people can go to and get our show when they would like it. However, for this Rewatchables, I would highly recommend turning on the video for it as well, because just seeing Spielberg interact with those guys. And yet, even Simmons, who has been around, he's had Tarantino on his show. He has had big name guests on his show. He's done the Netflix documentaries on wrestling, the McMahon documentary and the Andre the Giant HBO documentary. Those were his. You know, he's worked in the business himself. But the fact that he's sitting there with Spielberg, they were not fawning over him, but they were just having a conversation. At one point, Simmons' co-host, he says something, and Spielberg just goes and says, "You know what? This was the highlight of my day. Even though I've loved talking about this movie with you guys, that point you just made is what I'm going to take away from this show." And it just blew everyone away. Fantastic show. And Disclosure Day, gotta say, looks pretty remarkable. Will there ever come a time when we cover Disclosure Day? I swear I'm getting to Jeremiah here pretty quick, but let me close that off by saying I don't think we would, because knowing me, if I'm going to do a movie like that, I would like to turn it into a whole series of shows. Meaning, if I were to do that, I would have to cover all of Spielberg's quote-unquote alien movies. Meaning, we would do Close Encounters, we'd do E.T., we would do War of the Worlds, and we would get to Disclosure Day. There is one movie, I mentioned this way back at the other place when I was doing their show, it might have been as a guest. One movie I swore I would never cover in my life is E.T., because I just have too much of an emotional connection to that movie, and there's no way I could look at it objectively. But Disclosure Day looks fun, and I look forward to seeing what Spielberg can do. All right, I've kept people waiting long enough. Jeremiah, me and him talk about video game adaptations. We talk about how he got involved in the biz. We talk about his brilliant use of sound in The Mortuary Assistant. We talk about his amazing cast that he got together for this. A lot of things we go over. Jeremiah's a great dude. It was a pleasure talking to him. So without any further ado, I'm just going to shut my mouth and get right to it. Here's Jeremiah Kipp. Jeremiah, how are you, sir?
I'm great, Garrett. Nice talking to you.
It is a pleasure talking to you. I don't know if you remember, you and I met through a mutual friend probably about 12, 13 years ago, there were a couple projects that we wanted to bring you in on, and you know how Hollywood works. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. I had heard nothing but good things about you and your work ethic and how much you love making films and whatnot. I think we might have been on a Skype call or two at that time, if I remember correctly. Do you remember any of this?
Yeah, this. I mean, you know, the it's always great when you meet someone along the road, and then you catch up with them again, you know, maybe a decade later. This is very frequent in the movie business.
It really is, and we had a few projects on the going full throttle, and then as things happen, you know, things did happen that kind of fell through, and then I got out of the business. I moved out of Hollywood and whatnot. And you know, started a whole lot of life, and look at what's going on now. I start this dopey podcast, and you have the number one movie on Shudder. Congratulations!
Well, thanks, Garrett. I appreciate that.
Okay, so how did you get interested in the business? I do want to kind of start with that angle because, goddamn, it is a hard business to get into, isn't it?
It is. I feel like I was very lucky, and I also just worked very, very hard. So it was really a little bit by accident that I got started in the well, not by accident. You know, it's I was a kid running around with a movie camera in the backyard making movies with my friends. And I was able to go to New York University's film program because we got a grant from a family whose child had passed away in an accident involving a horse. And they were looking to help support somebody live their dream and go to art school. And film school was close enough. So I went to NYU and made films there. And my first foray into actually being a part of the business was I was an intern at Killer Films. And Killer Films, at the time, were producing films like I Shot Andy Warhol and Velvet Goldmine. Mm. And they were about to do a movie directed by an artist named Cindy Sherman called Office Killer. And, you know, I was an intern there, and then I was like a PA, and it was my first time on set and working at a production company and seeing how the whole thing worked. And I don't know, I think work begets work, and, you know, good work with good people will lead to more good work with more good people. So really, you know, what happened was I got out of film school expecting the industry to greet me and hug me and give me a job, but you know, it didn't work out that way. So I wound up working for all sorts of different film companies. Like there was a nonprofit filmmaker organization called the Independent Feature Project that was a membership organization for filmmakers. And my intern there was this Swedish guy named Ule. And Ule was like, "Hey, we get together every Sunday and we make a movie and we call ourselves the Sunday Club. Do you want to join up?" And I was like, "Sure." And, you know, it kind of kept going that way for me. Like, we made a bunch of movies, and then we got more ambitious and made movies with actual budgets. And, you know, ultimately, you know, my first feature got made because the producers had seen a short film I'd done. My second feature got made because they'd seen a short film I'd done. The third feature was an investor was going to put money into the second feature but didn't. But I pitched him another idea, and we went and made that movie. So you can see that, like, just like doing a project will lead to another project, will lead to another project. And indeed, that's how Mortuary Assistant came about, the video game adaptation that I that premiered on Shudder in March of this year. Was I'd made another independent feature called Slapface.
Yeah.
There was a monster movie with a little, you know, little boy and his monster.
I remember it. That was
darker.
That was pretty intentional film. I watched it when it actually premiered because I remembered almost working with you and things. So I was like, oh, it's Jeremiah's new film, and I watched it and I quite enjoyed it actually.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that was a labor of love. Yeah, really intense little movie. And the sales agent for that project was Epic Pictures Group. And the distributor in English-speaking territories was Shudder. So Epic owned Dread XP, which is the video game division of their company. And their biggest success was a game called The Mortuary Assistant. And it was an international viral hit, you know. So they decided, because because it achieved such popularity, they wanted to make a movie out of it. And since I was already in the family, so to speak, with Slapface, I interviewed for the job, and the game creator, Brian Clark, really liked my take on the material. And then we went through a period of development for a couple of years where a writer named Tracy Beebe
Yeah.
developed the script.
I know Tracy. Tracy, I know through another mutual friend,
Oh, okay. Yeah,
Laura
you should talk to her
Bendixson.
too.
Yeah,
You know,
she's a sweetheart.
she essentially got through the door by, her representation sent Epic Pictures Group a horror movie about a shark, a shark movie. And they were like, all right, we're not looking to do a shark movie right this second, but we are developing Mortuary Assistant, and she pitched for it and got that job. So once Tracy's script was approved by Epic and by Shudder, who were involved in this project from the beginning, we were off and running and made the video game into a movie, and here we are today.
And here we are today. Yes. So, you covered so much I was going to ask you about, but I want to go ahead and start because here's the thing about the approach I was going to take with this, Jeremiah, is,
Sure.
our website, I don't know if you've listened to anything that we've done on this particular site, but we do retrospective reviews, meaning we do franchises. We do one movie at a
Amazing.
time. And one thing that the guys have been kind of pushing me to do, and I've been kind of pushing back, although we might do it soon. If we do it, it's going to be quite an undertaking, is video game adaptations.
Oh my gosh, that's a mammoth
Yeah,
undertaking.
well, look, I'm already putting them through a Stephen King film retrospective that covers all his adapted works from pu in publishing order. So you can
Yeah, but I
see.
mean, with Stephen King adaptations, even though there are some that are not liked, you're going to run into films directed by luminaries like Brian
Correct.
De Palma and David Cronenberg and Stanley Kubrick. And video game adaptations is a thornier road, to say the
Definitely.
least.
Definitely. That's what I was going to ask you is video game adaptations, the batting average for video game adaptations is pretty low. My question to you is, how do you approach, because you said that they approached you with this, right? So
Yeah.
how do you approach adapting this video game for Shudder?
Well, it was never my dream to adapt a video game into a movie. It was, even though there are many great video games that I love to play, like Mouthwashing is a great indie horror game that's come out pretty recently. When Epic approached me, they didn't say that it was the Mortuary Assistant. They were like, hey, do you want to adapt a video game? And my response was something really diplomatic, like, why the hell would I want to do that? But then once I played the Mortuary Assistant, I loved the game immediately, and I saw the possibilities for it as a movie. It's very spooky scenario where you're a young mortician in the game, and just walking in and dealing with a dead body is creepy enough when you have your clipboard and you're going through the process of embalming, which is inherently fascinating. And then, like the deeper you go into the game, you realize that you're in a haunted space where there's supernatural forces at work that are trying to get inside you and possess you. But just the characters of the game I found really interesting from the get-go. Like, I thought Rebecca Owens was a compelling protagonist. And I liked the idea of the hero of a movie being someone who is empathetic to the dead, because it's just a fascinating world. The minute you walk into a night shift in a mortuary, you're already in a strange liminal space, that is atmospheric and strange and unique. And I liked the way that the game approached the monsters. They infiltrate you in your mind, and they speak in the language of depression and suicidal ideation and addiction, and I liked all those qualities. And I thought that if we could get the audience to empathize with Rebecca Owens, the way that we project onto a character like Laurie Strode in the Halloween, in John Carpenter's original Halloween movie, like, we empathize with her because she's in a bad situation where there's a force of evil that is coming straight at her. And because we empathize with Laurie Strode, the force of evil is coming straight at us. And that was kind of my approach to the video game adaptation, was like, let's create a sympathetic character that the audience will care about, and then let's proceed to put her through sheer living hell. And it was all about the audience identification, because when you play a video game, you immediately empathize with the person that you're playing because it is and you are taking all those actions. Like, you feel in control of a game. But the reality is that a game is often, narrative-based game, like Mortuary Assistant is guiding you through a story with a beginning and a middle and an end. And in that sense, I thought that Mortuary Assistant had more in common with projects that have translated well from game to movie or series, like The Last of Us. Like, The Last of Us had wonderful characters in the game that had wonderful character arcs and was a great story. And when they turned it into a series, it made perfect sense. When you play the game, it feels like an HBO series.
Does.
It feels way more like a narrative-driven game than a puzzle-solving game or something.
Yeah.
And I thought Mortuary Assistant was very similar in that way.
Can I ask you,
Yeah,
because
go ahead.
Last of Us is very narrative driven,
Yeah.
and the thing about video games is when you get the best of them, like I'll give a couple of examples, like Metal Gear games
Sure.
or Life is Strange. Like they are already like fantastic narratives where I always th say to myself, and I even thought this until Last of Us started, which me and my fiance watch all the time.
Sure.
We watch Last of Us religiously. But before I even watched it, I'm like, how are you going to take this narrative and turn it into something that is on a cable network? You know, it's very, very, it's a very hard line to walk.
Well, I do fundamentally believe that most video games shouldn't be adapted into movies. I feel like it's a completely different medium. It's kind of like dancing and architecture. Those two things don't go to, it's like one has nothing to do with the other. They're both two different sports, let's say, both equally great. And often when you're playing a video game, something like Doom, which you all have the privilege of covering if you decide to do an entire season of video game adaptations. Like, playing that game is really fascinating because there's a lot of world building and you're experiencing, different locations and you're piecing together what the place is. But there aren't characters in that story. It's not even a story, it's an event. And when they made it into a movie, they have to create a character for The Rock and they have to create dramatic situations out of nothing. And consequently, nobody was really happy with that movie. Like, gamers saw it and felt betrayed, and then general audiences saw it and felt
Bored.
frustrated and bored, and like they were invited to a party where they didn't know anybody or have any frame of reference. And that wasn't lost on me when I approached directing The Mortuary Assistant. I mean, I loved the game, I loved the story, I loved the characters, and I loved the world of it. But I did in the back of my mind know that because playing a game is such a personal experience for the person engaging with the game, the player, it's like they're going to all have the movie in their mind of like what they expect out of a Mortuary Assistant film, and I guess I wasn't prepared for the shellacking I got from some people who love the game, but nevertheless, I don't regret making the movie because the thing that I decided was I was going to include the creator of the game, Brian Clark, every step of the way. Like, from the moment I was hired, he and I would be talking to each other. And originally he was going to be on set for only 5 days, but I kept him with me in pre-production to like so that he knew the way we were building the set, and like we would show him the blueprints and say, look, this is how we're mirroring the game and this is what we have to change because of the layout of the space.
That's highly unusual that,
Yeah, I mean, I wanted
that's a
him to be
brave
involved.
decision, Jeremiah, I
Oh,
have to
yeah. Well, I
say.
mean, a lot of the time it's hard to get the creator of the game involved. I mean, it's great because he's a solo game developer who made this game himself. And a lot, like a lot of other stuff like Doom, it's hard to like, it'd be a bunch of people you would have to bring into that creative process because there's people who design certain parts of a game and people who write certain parts of a game and certain people who are writing towards designs that were created by somebody else. So who are you supposed to go to stay true to the original vision of the game? And in this, it was very easy because Brian made every single thing that you see in that game himself. Every single sound that you hear was by him. So I kept him involved in the casting. I kept him involved in the production design. Once he was on set, I cast him as a dead body, which is an Easter egg in the game. He is one of the dead bodies in the game, and I thought that would be very charming. But he fell in love with the process of making a movie. He called his family and was like, "This is a once in a lifetime opportunity, and I really need to be here for the whole thing." So, he went away for a couple of days and then came back and was with us for the entirety of principal photography. And, at first he would stay behind he would be by the monitor in Video Village off the set. But as he felt empowered by me and by others, over time he was standing right next to me while we were making the movie, and I would just like be checking in with him saying, "Hey, Brian, how do you feel about this?" Like literally we were working with the actor playing the hero monster from the game, The Mimic, played by Mark Steger from Stranger Things. And I said, "Brian, just like act out for him what the monster, show him what the monster moves like, just demonstrate it." And I mean, Brian would demonstrate how the monster moved and the actor would copy him. And it was a really great way to keep the integrity of the original game involved while we were making the movie. This was all true through post-production. He saw every edit of the film. I made sure he was with me for interviews when we were talking to sound designers. And literally at the premiere, the very first screening in New York, like Brian was right next to me when we introduced the film together. So the game creator and I are friends now. And he fell in love with making movies. And I think his only regret is like he wanted, he's like, "Man, I wish I'd been even more involved from the beginning." And I think that now he has a real taste for it and wants to write movies now. And I think he ultimately wants to direct movies now. So like, in the credits, it says written by Tracy Beebe and Brian Clark.
Yeah, I was going to ask you,
Tracy,
they have a shared credit, so he helped write it, or was he?
well, Tracy wrote it, like she was hired to write it. So then she wrote it up to a certain point. And that was the script that got greenlit by Shudder and Epic. But then, like, Brian just got involved. Like, once he got involved in the filmmaking process, he was like, "Oh, let me do rewrites on this thing and personalize it and make it more true to the spirit of the game that I created." And I was all for it. So Brian and I would be like going over his material, and like he would frequently be doing rewrites. And that was great. Like, I love having the writer with me on set in general when somebody else has written the script. And it was lovely having Brian be a participant. And yeah, his one regret was like, "I wish I'd gotten involved even sooner. Like, I would have loved to have been there from the genesis of this instead of, instead of being an approval process." Like, he has an executive producer credit where he approved everything. But, like, just seeing how much he loved making movies and being on set with the crew and the cast, he was like, "Oh, if I'd known I would love it this much, I would have gotten involved way sooner."
That's so great. And the thing about that is they can go so wrong, which is why it's admirable that you would involve him as you did, because there's kind of like a bit of, and you know this more than anybody, I'm sure, there's a bit of gatekeeping when it comes to filmmaking where, okay, you stay in your lane, I will take care of the film stuff, but the fact that you made him so collaborative, I think it does show on screen, because that atmosphere in that game is really reflected in the movie. So it
Yeah,
paid
that was
off.
my highest priority, was like I wanted to create a cinematic representation of the world that Brian had made, and I think that he, like, I mean, just in the playing of the game, you see how many cinematic influences he has. It's pretty obvious that he loves cinema, and we talk about movies and games a lot, but we were able to talk creatively about like the entire vibe that we wanted to present on screen, and Brian was a huge part of that.
Okay, so a couple things I wanted to bring up throughout the course of this, because I did watch it this week. One, any fan of the OC, as I am, will recognize the lead of this. Miss Willa Holland, how was she to work with?
Will is very intense in a good in the good sense of the word, because she cares deeply. We before, like when she said yes to the project, it was pending a Zoom call, and I think that she'd just been through a lot of not very pleasant experiences in her professional life, and I mean, this is just like being, Will is very experienced. She's been acting in media since she was like 5 years old or something. Like Steven Spielberg was her next door neighbor and was like, kid, you got talent. We need to put you in the movies. So she literally has been on set more than she's been in school, you know? And, in some ways, this really wrecked her life because she was so used to living in non-reality of show business to like actually dealing with people. This is all by way of saying that, like, she really wanted to vet me and make sure that I was like a decent human being, and that she wanted to see if she could trust me. Obviously I passed the test because I felt like I'd said all the right things, but like she quite appropriately was wary of like, yeah, people say all sorts of lovely things in an interview and then you get on set and none of that is actually true.
I've experienced that.
And I think that she was very pleased to discover that like the atmosphere of making Mortuary Assistant, even though I love making dark, weird films, but I don't like being on a dark, weird set, And I like it to be a respectful environment where everybody's allowed to get their work done. As you see, like I involved Brian Clark and made him a collaborator on the project. I think that was something that Willa really liked. So essentially, she and I joined hands and did a trust fall together. And I'm glad that we did because, like the reviews of Mortuary Assistant have been, all over the place, like mixed, it would be a charitable way of saying it. But her performance is pretty undeniable. She really committed to the character and to the world of the Mortuary Assistant. And I couldn't be prouder of her. And I think that she brought a lot of that stuff I was talking about before, of like that feeling of being disconnected from reality, from being in the industry for so long. I think that she wanted to invest that into the character of Rebecca, who is more comfortable among the dead than among the living, because the living are complicated people and often dangerous animals, And I thought that Willa brought a lot of honesty to the part that came from years of operating within an industry where you can't trust people, And I really appreciated that she was so open to giving of herself that much. And for that, I'm deeply grateful to Willa Holland. And I mean, obviously, she brings her entire history and resume with her when she's on screen. It's like in many ways, I found it very handy to cast that actor who had been on The OC and on Arrow to play this part because the audience fills in, so much of who she is based on it being Willa Holland. And Hitchcock did that with Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart and loads of stars. And, so yeah, I never, Willa and I had a lot of conversations about the present tense, but we didn't have a lot of conversations about her previous body of work. I don't think we ever talked about the stuff that she'd done previous, other than her giving examples of how she didn't want to be treated. And we were very respectful of that, treated the project and her with a lot of integrity. I mean, because she's been in show business for so long, you want to listen to her ideas and you want her to be able to contribute. And, when you allow somebody to give of themselves that much, like they will feel like an artistic collaborator and they will only trust you more. And that was how it felt working
For
with
sure.
Willa.
Paul Sparks, I was a big House of Cards guy. How was he?
Paul Sparks was great. And as it turns out, Paul and I didn't know that we were both at NYU at exactly the same
Oh,
time,
that's funny.
the exact same years, in the exact same dormitory. He lived two floors above me while I was at NYU, and we didn't know each other at the time. But looking back, I think I know who Paul Sparks was, like when we were riding down in the elevator together and so on. We both went to the same building, Tisch School of the Arts. And we're around the same age, so like we're both, Gen X and get the same jokes and have the same references.
Cool stuff.
But yeah, Paul Sparks, I didn't think he was going to do the movie. Our casting director, Alison Estrin, recommended him. And I just had heard interviews with Paul where he had said stuff that where he was like, I don't, he was saying things about horror films being not very good, and I was like, he's not going to want to do this movie. And Alison was like, he may surprise you. I think that if we offer it to him, he's going to go for it. So same deal, we made an offer to Paul and we had to do a Zoom meeting for an hour. And as it turned out, I asked him about it directly. I was like, "So you don't like horror films?" He's like, "No, I love horror films. I just want to do, smart, interesting horror films with characters that I want to play." And he brought up stuff like Hereditary, but he also had seen Slapface and was a and really loved it and
Nice.
was very moved by it. And I think that was one of the reasons why he wanted to do Mortuary Assistant was like he really loved my previous film.
That's quite a compliment.
It's very, yeah, it's highly
Yeah.
complimentary. And then Paul's just a dream to work with. Like he's an actor's actor. He's that kind, he's the kind of actor where like he's gonna, like he did a deep dive into the game and the character. He found all the different endings. He was going on Reddit threads and discovering the lore. Like he was writing like essay long descriptions of the character and the architecture of the character. So he was very committed to, building a scaffolding for this guy. And he was a joy. Like Willa was very intimidated by, Paul's a very lovely guy, but Willa was like, "I'm very nervous with Paul coming in because he's such a great actor. I need to be on my game when I'm with him." And I think part of that is like the actors sometimes become a part of their character, and Rebecca is, very aware of Raymond's mystery and his status. But yeah, once they got to working together, they were very good dance partners and very good collaborators, and Paul, of course, is just the nicest guy. So like he plays a character that is strange and elusive, and Paul himself is very generous and kind. One of the other things I liked about Paul was I tend to show up early when I, during the shooting days. I'll get to set early and walk around the set and think about what I want to do that day. And I discovered that Paul Sparks was already there. So he and I were both like the first guys to show up on set every workday. And I was very touched by that. I was like, "Oh, we're both as equally committed to doing the work on this movie."
Yeah, you mentioned that he had mentioned that he wasn't a big fan of horror films. I talked about something when we reviewed Scream 7, earlier this year, about the fact that that movie made a lot of money, and the horror genre is not the quote unquote ghetto of film anymore. Like you have things like Sinners getting nominated for 16 Academy Awards. Do you find that you're in a genre that is actually kind of respectable now?
Well, I think that the horror genre is respectable. Like movies like Hereditary and The Witch, Babadook, like definitely paved the way for projects like Obsession to come along that are critically acclaimed, making money hand over fist. But I think that the ghetto now, like it's video game adaptations kind of remain the ghetto of cinema. It's just a much maligned subgenre, and that's even with Markiplier's Iron Lung movie, which I really quite liked.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Like that movie made so much money, and at first the reviews were pretty mixed, but like once the box office was undeniable, the reviews got weirdly better. And Exit 8 also like seems like it's been navigating that path really well. I mean, that movie looked awesome and got some decent reviews. So I think that The Last of Us did help video game adaptations get some level of attention and acclaim. But and Fallout, of course. But movie adaptations, this year, like Return to Silent Hill, of course, took quite a pummeling. And and Mortuary Assistant was no stranger to getting punched in the face. But I think that the horror genre has been legitimized. And it's weird, the video game genre hasn't yet, even though I think some of the most creative work out there right now in the horror space are indie horror games, which have amazing stories and a kind of general weirdness to them that most movies can't touch. And because a lot of indie horror games are made by solo developers, they feel they kind of have the integrity of something that's uncompromised. And movies are often compromised by executives who are second guessing themselves and making safer choices, and that can really cripple a movie. But the video game world, they don't have that overhead. So consequently, the work can be very, very singular and very strange in ways that I really like. And I think a lot of those things can make really great movies.
Definitely.
And I think the sky's the limit. With executives scraping YouTube, for content creators, I dare I say filmmakers, because a lot of them are so talented. Talk to Me and Obsession were wonderful films. Like, video games are also a market that people are tapping into because, because, as you said earlier, Mortuary System, for all of the, Rotten Tomatoes being thrown at us, it is number one on Shudder. It did have like one of the top five biggest openings of any movie on Shudder, and it's, in the top 10 most watched movies of their entire library, meaning everything on Shudder, more people have watched Mortuary System than most of the things that are on Shudder,
Wow.
including a lot of films that I love. I encourage people to dig deep into Shudder and see a lot of the great indie films that are there that don't get as many views as Mortuary Assistant has. But that's been something that's kind of boggled my mind, is like, how can Mortuary Assistant get, maligned on the one hand, but also be the most popular on the other? And it makes me think, oh, maybe that's how movies like Transformers 2 happened, where nobody has a good word to say about it, yet it, they kept making the sequels because it was so popular and it was making so much money. And
Definitely.
I've never aspired to being Michael Bay, but it's interesting to be in that given circumstance right now, where I've made something that remains popular. It's like it landed at number one when it opened, and then it got pushed out by Dolly, which is an excellent film. But then Dolly, disappeared, and we went back to being number one. And that happened a couple times with Whistle and a wonderful film called Night Patrol that I encourage everybody to watch. Such a cool movie. Like, those movies kind of took over the spot, and I was like, okay, I guess it's over for Mortuary Assistant. But it keeps creeping back into that number one spot, which means people continually are watching it. And that's boggled my mind a little bit. It's like, how can people keep watching it when the word of mouth has been pretty sour, and I honestly don't know the answer to that, Garrett.
You know
I'm
what?
certainly
I have a
that
theory
people watch
about it.
the movie.
I have a theory if I can jump in here real
Sure, I'd
quick.
love to hear.
My theory about it, because I'm one who, look, as I mentioned, I love Metal Gear to pieces. I'm not a big video game player anymore. However, if a Metal Gear game comes out, I will make a point to get it.
Of
I
course.
think the name recognition, because Mortuary Assistant, I dug deep into the history of that game. It has a real niche following, and
Big time.
people really like it. And I think if they see that there's a movie based on it, they will go out of their way to find it and watch it. And so
Without
I
a doubt.
think a lot of it is name recognition, and I do think Will Holland has an audience, and I think that has a little bit to do with it as well. So I think
Well,
those two
I don't
things kind of
deny
help
any
too.
of it, but the funny thing is, Garrett, that like, if this movie had not been, let you know, like, if this movie had not been based on a very popular game, then this movie would not have gotten made, and like, that is the weird thing about intellectual property, is that, people want to see something based on a name that everybody has heard of. And it just makes you wonder, like, how many great movies are out there that haven't been made, that don't have an IP behind them, it's just harder for those movies to scrape to the top and get their financing and all that other stuff. It wasn't lost on me at all that, like, I love the game, The Mortuary Assistant, and I'm so delighted that it's got its immense niche popularity, because it's always a win when something that weird and something that daring and something that singular and that original finds its people, and then we find each other. Like, Brian Clark, the game creator, and I became friends because we have many common interests and we love a lot of the same things. And I think that he was very happy that his game got made into a movie, just because it's like, that's a real achievement in the game world. There's a lot of games that are also great that, have a following but aren't attached to a production company. And it's harder for some of those things to get made. Like, there's a great film director named Brendan Salisbury, who made the George Romero's Resident Evil
Oh,
documentary.
yeah.
And he's got the rights to Faith, the Unholy Trinity, which is a magnificent, weird, interesting, singular game. And the game creator gave him the rights because he knew that Brendan understood it. And they're trying to get the movie financed, and they don't have a production company behind them. Now, I'm pretty sure that they will get it made because it's a very popular game with a built-in audience, not unlike Mortuary Assistant. And Brendan's a wonderful filmmaker. And I know that he's very well aware that, if they make it into a movie, he's going to take his lumps just like the rest of us. But he loves Faith, the Unholy Trinity as much as I loved Mortuary Assistant. Brendan was a little jealous of me. He was like, "Damn it, man, you got to Mortuary before I did." I hope for the best for his movie. I know he's a super talented filmmaker and a really smart guy. That movie, as popular as the game is, it's like the thing that was great about Mortuary Assistant was there was a production company in place that owned the game that could make the movie. And that really did tip the scales a little bit in its favor.
Yeah, I noticed the Lego logos when they came up in the beginning.
Sure.
It seemed like it was a video game company. Couple more things before I let you go. One, when I watched this last week, I watched it late at night. My fiance had gone to bed, and we have a pretty good sound system in our house. And I had that thing turned up, and let me tell you, I don't know who you got to do the sound of this thing, but holy shit. Great sound design in this film, if I may say. How did you go about putting that atmosphere together? Because I know when you do post, it's not easy to get all that down as well as you did.
Yeah, it was a critically important hire. The sound designer is Jeffrey Allen Jones, and he also did the score for the film.
Okay.
That was one where, like I said earlier, I wanted the game creator with me on the interviews to talk to sound designers because I felt like it was such a vital component in the storytelling. And the thing that was very cool about Jeffrey was when we interviewed him. He, we talked, you know, we were, you know, it was like the 30-minute interview that actually went on, I think, for an hour or maybe an hour and change, because he did such a deep dive into thinking about what about the location, and like how you want to make the total atmosphere of Riverfield's mortuary come alive. And then he talked a lot about the level of research he'd done on mortuary science, because scene one of our movie is intense close-ups of the embalming process, and like every sound that you hear is a specialized sound that Jeffrey created, with his team. It was one of those things where like we needed to get the mortuary science correct and grounded in a kind of reality, so that when we did the spooky, spooky happenings with evil spirits, that stuff exists in a place that is coming that started from base level reality. So I loved working with Jeffrey. He was a very committed total artist. And he took some big swings that I was very that I always am I'm always excited by. So it was he was he like after we were done talking to him, we decided that he was the guy for the job. And then yeah, he and Brian and I just kept engaged in a conversation for however long it was, like a month and a half or 2 months of sound design, slowly building out the world of our movie. But I wish that sound design was in the opening. He's credited as a composer in the opening credits, and just the rules delegate that like sound design is a end credits title. But I hate that in horror movies because I think that sound design is as important as the brilliant cinematography of Kevin Duggan or the brilliant production design of Chelsea Turner on our movie. Jeffrey Allen Jones' sound design is as much a star as the cinematography and the production design or the edit by Don Money. So
Correct.
I'm happy that you brought him up because I think it's a vital component, not just in Mortuary Assistant, but in any horror film worth its salt.
Absolutely. And it can go wrong. I think, as talented of a director as James Wan is, I think a lot of his stuff relies on sound to the point where it stings you to death. Where there is a ton of jump scares and a ton of just falsities, where you're just like, can you move on with the story and stop trying these cheap tricks? The stuff you do in this movie is not cheap. It all has a payoff, and that's what I respected about it. So good job on that.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. That really matters to me.
Definitely. Now, A big podcast I listen to, I've listened to for a while, I'm a patron of theirs, is The Movie Crypt, and you were on that about a month ago. How was that experience?
I'm a huge fan
Yeah.
of those guys, of Joe and Adam. I really love their podcast because they are committed to a certain honesty that is refreshing
Yes.
within this business, where they're really open to talking in a warts and all kind of way about their successes and their failures, or the ways that they've been thwarted from achieving the dream that they wanted to achieve. And both of those guys have substantial and meaningful careers in the industry. They're like indie film heroes who have made some wonderful films, but they were also enormously candid when things went wrong or when they got screwed, which is probably a more appropriate way of saying, what happened, of the reality of the given circumstance of what's happened to them some of the time. And yet they have such integrity and they just keep going. And because of their honesty, the filmmakers who are on their show are willing to talk about anything and everything, and they will share just as much as Joe and Adam do. Now, I did their show and I was very honored to be on it. And I really loved the interview. And I remember feeling afterwards, like I was like, man, I feel like I feel like I maybe was a little too vulnerable. I didn't mean to turn that into a therapy session at the end when I was like talking about my problems, but I talked to them afterwards and they were like, no, man, that's the entire point of what we do. It's like we want people to be able to talk about the stuff that is hitting them, because it's like the old adage, be kind to everyone because we are all fighting our own battles. Whether it's Renny Harlin or Bernard Rose, or Natasha Kermani, or Bria Grant or me on their show, like talking about the shit that goes down in this industry, I felt I after talking to them, I was like, yeah, what they're doing is important. And it's actually vital that we're able to talk about the things that matter to us without fear that, it's gonna blow back on us, because it's very frowned upon in this industry to say that things aren't going well, but I think Joe and Adam are like able to create a forum where it's like, yeah, maybe you did fail, but that's how you learned, and by that process of learning, you went on to do something else that was meaningful to you, and they look at it more as a journey, as a marathon, not just a sprint, and for that, I really deeply value their show, and I really value and love those guys for what they do.
Did they reach out to you?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. That's
Yeah, I was really honored.
yeah.
When Joe Lynch was like, I want Jeremiah on the show, it was I may have done a fist pump in the air because, like I deeply admire
Yeah.
those guys, and I
Well,
really admire.
my least favorite part is when Lynch goes, people who review on Letterboxd, that's where they go to die. And I'm like, wait a second, I'm on
Well,
Letterboxd.
I
That's
mean,
no
yeah, I
fair.
mean, they're
I know what
they
yours mean,
really
though.
do take the, they do take the adage of like, well, fuck the critics, fuck them, and I do not feel that way. I have enormous respect for the people who write about movies, and like, Megan Navarro for Bloody Disgusting, she wrote that Mortuary Assistant was boring, meandering, and not scary. That was the headline,
Jesus.
and I was like, yeah, that doesn't feel great, but that doesn't diminish any of the respect I have for Megan Navarro as a writer, as a person with her finger on the pulse of the horror genre. I take her writing really seriously, and I take her really seriously. I think that she's an important, horror critic in the world of filmmaking, and what she says matters, and what she says, I was like, man, this is going to cost me. This is going to cost Jeremiah Kipp personally, but, meaning, somebody's going to read that review and not see the movie, or representation will read that review and the others and be like, eh, maybe if he makes another good film down the line. So that is the level of power that the critics have. But I think that they serve a vital and necessary function because we need somebody on the front lines saying, this is what we think, and you want them to do it with candor and you want them to do it, with sincerity. And if somebody's trashing my movie just to trash it, I have no respect for that. But if somebody's like taking it seriously and genuinely considering it, then I have to accept the great reviews that we got for Slapface just as much as the reviews that we got on Mortuary Assistant,
Definitely.
which were, it's like, it's mid. It's like I take all of it seriously. And whether it's like a great review or a bad review, I think there's something to learn from all of it.
My favorite part about those guys is they are extremely candid about the fact that they have done that podcast for as long as they have has probably, in fact, it more than definitely has cost them jobs
I know it has.
because of how honest they are about the industry and what they've gone through. I just love those guys. I am the highest of patrons on their Patreon. They are,
Wonderful. They
yeah,
deserve
they
it.
it takes me an hour to get to and from work every day, and they keep me company a lot. I love the fact that I was able to listen to you, a friend,
Oh,
on
that
that
makes me
show. That was
happy.
pretty cool.
Yeah, it was a privilege and an honor. I mean, I listened to their show. So it was really nice to be a guest. So like I think I even said while I was on it,
Yeah, you did.
first time caller, long time listener.
All right. Well, you have the number one movie. It is The Mortuary Assistant on Shudder. You have to have offers coming in. What do you got going on next?
There are offers coming in, and I don't know, it's I've been very selective, about what I want to do next. I have turned, it's like I don't want to sound like whatever, however it sounds, it's like I've turned down a lot of stuff because it's like if I do another video game adaptation, I want to love it as much as I loved Mortuary Assistant, because otherwise there's really no point for me to do it. Somebody else can do it, and I've been, there've been possibilities for other, I can't really talk about any of the things that are like in the works right now. I can say that there's a couple things in development, that but it's the usual things that are happening in development where people are looking at a certain caliber of actor and deciding if they want to line up that actor with that budget and so on and so forth. So there's things in development that I want to do, and there's a couple projects that are like have certain amount of investors lined up and are looking for the first one to dive into the pool. So all that stuff is present and correct and good. And I did get representation out of Mortuary Assistant, so that obviously was like very cool. But like all the stuff that's going on right now, unfortunately, I'm not in a position where I can talk about it because of non-disclosure agreements.
All right. Well,
I can't say I made a movie in Cambodia in the jungle the winter after making Mortuary Assistant, and it's called The Faceless. And all I can say about that one is to any filmmaker who has a script set in the jungle, I would say, don't go. Making a movie in the jungle is one of the hardest things I've ever done. It's like when Spielberg did Jaws, he vowed never to work in the water again. And my sympathy and my heart goes out to Francis Ford Coppola and Oliver Stone and John McTiernan and every director who's made a jungle warfare movie. It is no picnic. Mine was a Monster in the Jungle movie, didn't make it any less difficult. Humping it in the bush is like one of the hardest things I've ever done. The jungle looks great on camera, but boy, oh boy, is it tough to make a movie there. So The Faceless is coming out probably next year sometime.
Nice. Next year sometime. One thing I noticed, we reviewed Predator last year in preparation for Predator Badlands. And one thing I pointed out and I noticed in watching the original Predator again is the fact that they are on that jungle and that is uneven ground. How they were able to keep that camera as steady as they did on that ground is, I still don't know how Maternion was able to do that. It's a really phenomenal piece of filmmaking.
I know. I'm sad that John McTiernan no longer has a
Yeah, me
professional
too.
filmmaking career, because Predator and The Hunt for Red October and Die Hard and and some of his other films too
Yeah.
are among my favorites. And I always look to John McTiernan as inspiration and influence because
Definitely.
he's a master of visual storytelling.
Well, instead of talking to those losers, Adam and Joe, if you have something else coming out, you are more than welcome to call me, sir. I would love to have you back on. I know you are pretty active on social media. You did something last week that I found very interesting where you talked about Martin Scorsese talking about Bad Lieutenant, which was
Oh,
fun to
yeah.
read. I liked reading that. You're one of the nice ones, man. It's hard to find a nice guy in Hollywood, but that's exactly what you are. And I couldn't be happier for you. So thank you for taking the time.
Well, I appreciate it, man. You and Adam and Joe, I mean, we're all in this together, honestly. Navigating the waters of filmmaking, where you need to protect the vulnerability and sincerity of your open heart underneath the thick rhino skin. You need the healthy combination of both of those things to survive in this wild ride called show business. But
Definitely.
ultimately, it's about the movies and how much we love them. So thanks for keeping that spirit alive.
Thanks, man, and keep me informed, and I would love to talk to you again.
Sounds great.
All right, Jeremiah, thank you so much, sir. Great insight in that interview. Man alive, go to Shudder, check out The Mortuary Assistant, and yes, The Mortuary Assistant is not getting the best of reviews. However, I would still recommend checking it out because it does give you a good feel for the video game that it's portraying. And there's some really tense moments, and like I mentioned, the sound in it is tremendous. So definitely give it a shot, Jeremiah. Thank you, sir. Okay, like I promised in the beginning stages of this podcast, let's go over our next couple retrospectives. As I record this, and I'm pretty sure Matt's going to be posting it midweek, so I'm not going to be losing any ground when I mention this, but we are in the midst of Different Seasons by Stephen King, a book that means a lot to me personally. And these three stories, these three podcasts, two out of the three of them, I gotta tell you, it gets tears out of at least one of us. I think one of them, two of us lose it in the course of recording those shows. And the other one just generates plain anger. Definitely the most personal set of shows that we've done in a long time. This week, it's Shawshank. The week after, it is Apt Pupil. The week after that is Stand By Me. And then we conclude that leg of Stephen King by talking about Christine. And that ended up being a pretty damn good show, too. Really happy with those set of shows. Also, like I mentioned, this weekend, me and the guys are going to be talking Mandalorian. When we post that, I have no idea. I guess we better post it soon before another YouTube movie comes out and not just knocks it completely out of theaters. In fact, this week, Masters of the Universe is knocking Mandalorian out of IMAX screens a week earlier than it was contracted to. Speaking of He-Man, that leads us to the next set of shows after we're done with King. Yes, we are covering Masters of the Universe. No, we're not going to do the cartoon movie that they started things with where they had two episodes back to back. However, we are doing the 1987 Masters of the Universe film, and we're following it up with this year's pretty good buzzed Masters of the Universe film. With the 2026 sheen on it. I gotta be honest, guys, I cannot wait for this movie. I really can't. It's something that is born out of my childhood. And poor Matt, just, I don't know if he gets to talk more than six sentences on that first Masters of the Universe podcast, because all me and Adam do is talk about Masters of the Universe. And all Matt does is talk about how miserable he was having to sit and watch the canon films, Masters of the Universe with Dolph Lundgren. So, that's coming up, and then I'll give out one more that we're doing. Right after that, we covered a lot of adult topics, throughout these retrospectives this year. We have another set of shows that are going to be dealing with adult topics. This time, through the eyes of toys. Yes, we are doing the Toy Story retrospective as well. Yes, it is something me and Matt covered at the old place, but yet again, we have another theatrical movie coming out this year. And yet again, I just thought it'd be great to have us core three cover those films. And those films get pretty, pardon this pun, those films get pretty animated as well. So those are the ones I'm going to mention now. And there's a big one after that, but you're going to have to stay tuned. We're not going to announce it till later, but we are in the midst of recording that one as well. Okay, that about does it for this edition, this huge edition of Percolated Media Presents. I would like to thank Jeremiah Kipp. Thank you, sir, for coming on. When's the next Percolated Media Presents? I don't know. It comes up as it comes up, guys, but thank you, and stay tuned as we have A Leg of King coming up, and then we have the power! I was going to end this with a huge rocker with Tarja and Danny from Cradle of Filth. They had a single that came out earlier this year, but you know what? I started this show pretty rocking, so I want to slow things down a bit. I'm still going to have Tarja and This is a song she did called Tired of Being Alone. And this is a song that I actually used to listen to with my sister as we were on our way to and from college way back when. It's a softer song. It's pretty tremendous. And thank you, everyone. And talk to you soon. Happy birthday, Amanda. Bye.
Once you dreamed of me twice, you wished that I'd pull you out. You chose.